Good morning. Ooh, boy, is that loud. Good morning and welcome to Trending Now on MSO Newsports.com. I'm Rick Bourne. I got to figure out the level on these meters. My goodness gracious, that's loud. Are you hearing this?
Yeah.
Really loud? God, you're loud too. Okay, we'll see if we can adjust the levels here, and we will. I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh Arnold. This is Trending Now on MSO News Sports. It's heard most Fridays here on MSO, although we have to break every now and then. And Josh is our co-host here, and he lines up the guests. What you got this week, Josh?
We have Amanda Orlando Kesterson, chairwoman of the Gloucester Republican City Committee, again weighing in on the presidential election. We've got Maggie Howard, Deputy Director of Action Inc. in Gloucester. And we have Julie LaFontaine, the Executive Director of the Open Door in Gloucester.
All right, sounds like a plan. We'll be back.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Hey folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Amanda Orlando Kesterson. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me back.
What is the latest on the election? What are you saying out there?
Well, geez, there's been a lot of activity in the last week.
Yes.
I think what we're seeing is a daily explosion on the Clinton campaign as more and more gets leaked from these emails that they've uncovered, and more digging gets done by the media to find out what it is that the FBI had that encouraged them to reopen the investigation. So because the media is now on the hot seat to dig and find the truth, we're getting a daily amount of new information coming out every single day. And I think it's really hurting her. And the wheels are starting to come off the Clinton campaign, and you're seeing the reaction to that as Trump, as the polls sort of move in the other direction for Trump. We're seeing him gain in the polls steadily as days go on in all of these battleground states. And so it's a direct reaction to what's happening in the news cycle, which the media really has to report on, which they don't like to do, but they really have to, because they're trying to find the truth about what it is, what's the smoking gun that the FBI had. So that's what I'm seeing. I think it's not good for her going into the last weekend before the election.
When I went to college, one of the fraternities had an event in the spring every year called Mudfest, and they had this pit they filled with mud and water, and it was a drinking thing, and people, you know, you went into the thing, and you know, whether it was a tug of war or whatever, everybody was covered with mud.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what the election's starting to look like to me, because, you know, the old saying is when you're trailing in the polls, you attack, and that there's proven statistics that if you're behind, that you can catch up, you can gain ground with that by tons of advertising, tons of marketing.
Right.
And yet, if you step back from that, you know, what the public seems to want is they don't want the mud. They want someone to say, this is what's wrong with the country. This is what I'm going to do to fix it. This is why my views are different than my opponent's.
Right.
Instead, it's like, you know, who can dig up the juiciest rotten tomato and the biggest mud ball and fire it at the other person?
Well, that's true to some extent. I mean, I think that for the last month, we've been served a steady diet of nastiness about candidates' personal lives and things they said 15 years ago and old relationships. And, you know, it's been a pretty well constant drip, 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 drip on the public. Not substantive, not talking about the issues that face the country, just, you know, and mostly focused on Donald Trump. This is a little different. This isn't really mud that's swung by the Trump campaign towards Hillary. This is an independent governmental agency investigating her, and the media forced to report on that because it is legitimate political news. I mean, it's not a small thing that the Secretary of State possibly gave away classified information to our enemies. That's not a small thing, particularly when she's seeking the highest office in the land. So I wouldn't call it mud in regards to the FBI investigation. I do think the election as a whole has devolved and into nothing that really benefits the public, and more about the candidates' backgrounds and less about how they're going to approach the job, which is very unfortunate, but I think it happens every single election cycle. Negative campaigning happens every election cycle.
I heard commentators recently, within the last 48 hours, comparing Comey to J. Edgar Hoover. Now, we've had a number of FBI directors since J. Edgar Hoover, and I've read a bit about him, and he was had his own proclivities for playing politics and injecting himself, although not always in a public way, but very behind-the-scenes private ways. Do you think that... what's your take on what Comey did, and if he had to do it, or if he should have done something different?
Well, I think he never should have closed the investigation in July. I think that was playing more politics than reopening it now, to be honest. I think what happened, and I've done a lot of reading on it, is that the FBI investigators who were looking into it believed they had enough for an indictment, and Comey was the one that said, no, we're not going to do it. And I think that the staff was pretty upset with him.
And did you think that when Comey said, we're not going to do that, it was based on pressure he was getting from the Attorney General's office?
I do. I mean, there's Bill Clinton met with the Attorney General right before that decision was made and made public. There's a lot of evidence that shows that the Clinton campaign really pressured and the government, you know, the government under President Obama was really pressuring Comey back then to just, look, wrap it up. You don't have enough. Move on. Let this woman run for president. Remember, it was right before the conventions in July. It was, you know, that timing is much more, in my opinion, politically motivated. Because, frankly, if he had come out with an indictment against her in July, I doubt the Democrats would have nominated her.
Okay.
They would have found somebody else to run because they would have known they can't run a candidate who's literally been found, like, suspicious of a crime and going to face trial. They wouldn't have done that. So
now you have,
that was more politically motivated.
Now you have
then.
Reports that people in the Attorney General's office are calling the Clinton campaign and giving them a heads up on things that might come up in a hearing on Capitol Hill.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, they've had moles that have been giving them information all along. I mean, and not just within the investigation on Hillary, but in, you know, conversations about emails. There's been reports that there are emails that have been released by WikiLeaks that the FBI has where Podesta, John Podesta, is saying, we got to get rid of these emails. We got to get rid of these emails.
Well,
they were trying to get rid of this scandal. They've been trying to get rid of it for over a year.
I'm remembering back to Watergate, and Watergate was when the Senate Watergate Committee, Sam Irving and Howard Baker and company, were on every day, And anywhere you went in America, someone had a television on, and they were watching what was the next thing, what was the next piece of the orange that was going to come unraveled and show something. I'm seeing that a little bit, not to that extent, again here.
Well, I think what we're seeing is the unraveling of the Clinton machine. It's really unraveling. It's unraveling around her. And, I mean, some of the people who are closest to her, for example, Huma Abedin, who's been her aide for a long time, her closest confidant, and been with her through the trenches, it's her husband, Anthony Weiner, and an unrelated investigation which sparked this new information coming out. These are the people that are supposed to be keeping Hillary Clinton safe, and they are not able to anymore because the machine's becoming unraveled. People are starting to talk because they're like, well, this is a nightmare and I'm not going to put myself in jeopardy. I find it sadly amusing that Huma Abedin had 10,000 emails in a folder on her computer labeled life insurance. I mean, that just tells you a lot about the manipulative tactics of the Clinton campaign and the Clinton machine. So what we're seeing every day is more information coming out, whether it's through WikiLeaks or whether it's from the FBI or whatever, and it's the unraveling of a candidacy, it's the unraveling of a force of the Clinton machine. And I think people are tuned into it because in the end, when you boil it all down, they have to go in and they have to pick a candidate to vote for. And when there's one who's just always involved in scandal, as the Clintons always seem to be, most people think, I can't elect this person president of the United States.
There are reports that say he had to do this because he was facing a revolt within the FBI, that there were too many people who just felt like he was pushing it under the rug, and it was to hold off a mutiny within the FBI.
Yep, I have read that as well. I would not be surprised if that was the case. I really do think that he was forced to conclude the investigation in July and now was pressured to open it again. And unfortunately, I hate to think that the FBI director is so easily pressured, because that's not how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be an agency independent of the federal government in many cases. I mean, yes, funded by, but very much an investigative body that is supposed to be protecting all of us against corruption in our government.
If you look back at Watergate, they had the problem with leaks. People were leaking information. And so the Nixon White House came up with a group called the Plumbers Group, which was G. Gordon Liddy and company, E. Howard Hunt and others, and they were going to plug the leaks, if you will. And they had this plan that they wanted to put in place to neutralize their enemies, to silence the people who were being critical of them, and a whole bunch of other things. They brought J. Edgar Hoover in, and he told them all to go to hell.
Right.
He said, what you're asking is blatantly against the law, and I won't do it. And he walked out the door. So they did it anyway.
Right.
And after he died, they appointed L. Patrick Gray and Ehrlichman in cleaning out either the White House safe or the campaign headquarters safe, told Gray, these are never to see the light of day.
Right.
And said, deep six them. He says, what do you mean? Well, just you drive over the Potomac on your way home. Just throw them in the water.
It's always the cover up.
And it's always that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to. I look at Podesta's comments. We have to dump them now. There's one version of that that says, well, what we're saying is, let's get out in front of it. Let's put them out there so that everybody knows what we're talking about. So that it's not something hanging around our head that comes back and bites us late when we can't respond. Versus someone who looks at that and says, well, he's saying we have to destroy the evidence.
Right. And from John Podesta's standpoint as a campaign chairman, of course he was looking at the campaign and how that would affect the campaign. I mean, of course he'd want to get rid of the emails. I mean, that's not surprising. The trouble is, she was Secretary of State. So, you know, this isn't a private person's personal email address. I mean, this is, you know, she's this is classified information that she's, you know, emailing what, God knows who.
Trying to control
that and hide it shows a lot of a corrupt tendency, just like in Watergate. And that's, you know, of course. But the biggest thing is the Clinton campaign now has no choice but to say, well, just release them all. If you say that we've done something wrong, release all the emails. And it's such a manipulation tactic, because in the end, had she released all the emails that were hers, which she was requested to do and which Donald Trump, of course, was calling on her to do for months, if she had just released them all, we'd all know what was in there.
Well, it seems to me there are a couple of points here. One is that that's a when they say just release them to the FBI, they know when they say that one, they cannot do that, and two, will not do that.
Meaning the FBI.
Exactly, that's just not. Right. That's not. There's no way that's going to happen. Okay, so it's a.
Nor should it, by the way, because
it's a freebie. Okay, we can try to turn it around and do damage control, make it look like they have something to hide. So I get that. On the other hand, I see the. I think that the if there's a smoking gun here, if among the 30,000 or 33,000, the number seems to change, of emails that got bleached, if you will, if those emails are showing up on Huma's data that her husband had on the laptop, if some of those come into play, that's one issue. The other issue is there anything damaging among those that shows that it was something other than going to yoga class and plans for the wedding and all of that stuff? If it does, then that's the 18-minute gap, if you will.
Well, the reality is that, first of all, it's not possible that there are 33,000 emails about Chelsea Clinton's wedding and about yoga, first of all. Secondly, had it just been that, the way the Clinton campaign is trying to frame it, the FBI would not have reopened its investigation. So clearly, what was on Huma and Anthony Weiner's computers were smoking guns. And third, Hillary cannot stand before the American people and say, I have nothing to hide, while she's hiding 33,000 emails. So she has to make a decision, and she hasn't. She's decided to, you know, try to blame other people, and this is what she does. I mean, she did this with Bill Clinton, the vast right-wing conspiracy. It's always everybody else's fault. It has nothing to do with what she's done. She's innocent, and she's being transparent, except she's not. And the public doesn't trust her. The reality is the public, the American people, do not trust Hillary Clinton.
Lyndon Johnson.
The Clintons are corrupt.
Lyndon Johnson.
She's not surprised that things are being hidden.
Lyndon Johnson said, once you lose the trust of the American people, you can very rarely, if ever, gain it back. And that's a problem I think that both candidates have. There are trust issues on both sides, but this is more front and center right now.
Well, only one of the candidates has actually been in elected public office, meaning Hillary's job was to serve the American people. Being a senator and a she wasn't elected as first lady, but, you know, she was first lady, then she was a senator, and then she's secretary of state. She owed a duty to the American people. Donald Trump was a private citizen. Having the trust of the American people it's different. The trust issue is very different when you're talking about a public servant versus a private.
Well, I understand that, I understand the and appreciate the differences
right.
from which each comes. One of the things that I think is, I don't know, it's intriguing to look at. I have to think, the FBI, I understand the chronology that's being put forward. The FBI, looking at the Weiner case, saw this data, and as the story goes, they said, oh, well, what is this stuff? And so the team there went to the team that had done the Clinton investigation. And by rights, by process or procedures, or they couldn't reopen that case. They couldn't go into some of those emails without having to reopen that case and have justification for doing so. So there were some bureaucratic things that they had to go through before they could really sink their teeth into those.
Right.
I have to think that someone looked at the emails before they could legally, before they could legitimately have coursed to read them.
I agree.
And I mean, it's the slippery slope is it's the poison fruit argument. If you found something looking for something else, there's a point where you have to stop and say, wait a minute, this is outside of my jurisdiction. I can't go there. And maybe there's a temptation to do it anyway, and maybe they saw some stuff, and then they stopped dead in their tracks, or maybe they kept reading and just did the other thing parallel. I don't know that. You'd want to think that on the one hand, there was something substantive behind it, other than we found some stuff that we didn't know existed.
Well, I think, you know, yes. I mean, somebody's doing an investigation of something else, comes across something that they know is bad.
Yep.
They're going to read it.
Yeah.
It's human nature. Of course they're going to read it, and then they're going to go through the process of making sure that it can see the light of day in the right way so that nobody, you know, there's a legal system here. We have a legal system, and the FBI, of course, in the course of investigations, has to do everything by the book, because if they don't, then their evidence gets thrown out.
I've taught school law in the past at Gordon College, and one of the scenarios that I put forward was a policeman comes to the school on a bike issue. Somebody's bicycle got stolen, and they say, and in that, someone tells them that so and so has 3 ounces or a half a pound of marijuana in their pocketbook.
Right.
Okay. Now, at the school, the assistant principal has, or the principal has, more discretion in what they can do in terms of asking somebody to empty their pockets or take the contents out of a pocketbook or a knapsack or what have you than a policeman does.
Right.
But if the policeman says that to the assistant principal or principal and they go and do a search, the search would be construed as illegal because at that point they knew that the principal was acting as an agent of the police, and therefore the degree in which they had to have probable cause and a warrant would be in play.
Right, exactly.
And this is the same kind of thing we're talking about here.
Well, yes and no, because, first of all, the connection between Anthony Weiner and Hillary Clinton is not that...
It's
a lot closer.
Yeah.
First of all, and secondly, it's not. I mean, technically, yes. One investigative team was tipping off the other as to evidence they found in the course of their investigation that was pertinent to the other. And you know, it's no. Look, we're going to be realistic here. This is a presidential election. There are huge, huge things at stake, and I'm sure there's always, no matter how hard people try, political biases that go into anybody's thinking and thought process on it. So who knows who found those emails and what that person's perspective on it was politically. If they were a Hillary Clinton supporter, they'd probably be motivated to hide it. And if they weren't, they would be motivated to bring it to the light of day. But I like to have a lot of faith in our FBI and say that they were professionals and they knew the law and they knew what it meant and they brought it to the appropriate authorities, and that Comey looked at it and said, I have to reopen this investigation.
Okay.
Because if I don't, I am swaying an election, too, in addition to not investigating what's potentially a legitimate crime. So, I mean, there's a process and there's a legal system, and that's what investigation is all about. They could do this investigation and conclude that Hillary Clinton did nothing wrong or that there isn't enough to bring an indictment. That is possible. But when they concluded it in July, they did more to sway the election in July than they do right now, in my opinion.
Okay. So where does that leave us today? And here's the question I'm not clear on. We show the poll. Is there a definitive cause and effect relationship with the polling and the data that's circulating?
Yes.
And I don't know that one necessarily drives the other.
I think
people can infer that it has, okay, But it's not as clear and cut. I mean, Trump can be out there banging away at all of the revelations that he presupposes are going to come out from the FBI when they're done, some of which are coming out daily through WikiLeaks, assuming that that's all true. And some of them could be some level of exaggeration, and it's political rhetoric that's considered all fair game in an election. But all that aside, when someone says someone's lost 8 points in 10 days, does it necessarily mean it's because of this, or is it because of other factors? If you look at the election of 1968, if the election of 1968 were 2 weeks later, Hubert Humphrey would have won because he peaked late. That's what a lot of analysts believe. So there are lots of examples of where people have peaked late or peaked early, or there have been other variables that came into play. The analysts and the political commentators are attributing Trump's surging to Comey and Geraldo last night or this morning, I forget, talking about, well, this is going to be referred to as Comey's election.
That's interesting. Well, every single election cycle, there's something that happens which triggers a change or a shift of some kind that's usually unexpected. And sometimes it's a debate performance. There's sort of famous, like, from Ronald Reagan, and I forget which of his elections, where he had a really great debate performance, I think it was against Carter, and he managed, the polls shifted right after it. Like, that
it was
the performance.
Against Mondale. What happened he listened to his advisors who kept trying to bombard him with information, and he felt frustrated and didn't come across as well in his first debate. In the second debate, he said, "The hell with what they told me. I'm gonna be Ronald Reagan, and I'm gonna do what I do best, and that's communicate."
Right.
And that's when he said, "They're not gonna." The famous quote, "I'm not going to hold the fact that my opponent is much younger than me against..."
Right, the youth or something
that. And that's where it turned on him.
Well, I mean, sure, there are issues that there are events that happen that are out of people's control completely. I mean, 4 years ago, Hurricane Sandy hit, I think, 10 days before the election, and, of course, President Obama was able to fly there and look commanding and look in charge and, you know, rally... you know, the federal authorities and the state authorities and get everybody kind of organized, and it did affect perception of his abilities to be a leader. And of course, at that time, Romney was ahead, and we all know how that turned out. So things happen during elections all the time, some of which are in the candidate's control and some of which are not. As far as polling goes, I don't believe poll numbers. I didn't believe them 2 weeks ago when they said Trump was 12 points down, and I don't believe them now when they say Trump is 5 points up or whatever. I think what we look at is momentum.
I did a poll.
I think that's more conclusive to where the public perception is of campaigns than the numbers themselves.
I did a poll. I've done polling before in the past, in high school, college, and you know, farming it out as a contractor. And I did a poll in 1985. And I called the mayoral election within 5 votes and identified every precinct that each mayoral candidate was going to win.
Wow!
So
very impressive.
I mean, the problem I see with polling, and we have to wrap up and go to the next guest, is that they're using online vehicles, and I don't see the credibility of some of the ways that they're doing it. If I were polling you, I'd ask you if you voted in the last presidential election.
Right.
Okay.
Are you
a test question. Okay. And then I have to go back and I look at that. And if you didn't vote and you said you did, then I have to exclude your answers and then go to where you were numerically in my list and go up and down one or two people to keep the integrity of it. And I've seen polls locally where they didn't do anything like that.
Right.
And I think that's why you see such disparity and such movement from week to week.
I would agree. I don't think we can trust poll numbers. I think what we need to be looking at is which candidate seems to be shifting in which direction. I think that's more indicative of how the news cycle is affecting the election than the numbers themselves.
Well, thank you very much again for providing your insight and perspective, and we'll all know something better Tuesday. We are not on next week. It being Veterans Day, we are off, but we'll have certainly something to talk about going forward.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Amanda. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Maggie Howard, who is the Deputy Director at Action Inc. in Gloucester. Maggie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Josh. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we usually start out. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your bio, and so forth, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So I was actually born in Trenton, New Jersey, but did most of my growing up in southern New Hampshire in a really small town of about 1,800 folks. I went to high school at a small private prep school also in southern New Hampshire, where I was a lacrosse player and ran cross country for many years. Sort of a little known fact about me was that I was a champion Scottish Highland dancer for about 13 years, which was pretty exciting. A large chunk of my young life was dedicated to that. So after high school, when I graduated, I went to Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, where I majored in public policy, and I minored in education. It was a great experience. I'd had some great internships there, mostly at legal aid clinics, and it was just a fantastic time. Once I graduated from Hobart, I moved down to Quincy, Mass., right outside of Boston. I really had absolutely no idea what I was going to do, other than the fact that I knew my brother lived there. So for a short period of time, I worked as a real estate paralegal and then came to really discover that the sort of for-profit world wasn't for me, and I started working in the field of housing and homelessness. So I worked at an agency called HomeStart in Boston, which contracted with most major homeless shelters in the city of Boston to provide housing search and housing placement services. That was really my introduction to the world of housing and homelessness. So I was there for a little bit and then moved on to another housing agency called Metropolitan Boston Housing Partnership, which manages many types of subsidized and affordable housing. And in that capacity, I was a manager for Section 8 vouchers, and this is actually where I met my husband, who was also working in housing as a housing inspector. So he and I met, and shortly thereafter, he took me for a ride around the back shore of Gloucester, and I was convinced that I could never leave. So.
Yeah.
So at this point, I've been in Gloucester for just over 10 years, and when I first moved up to Gloucester, I just knew that I couldn't continue the commute to Boston, and looked for a job right up here in Gloucester. So Chris and I actually, we married in 2010, and along the way, I got a master's in nonprofit management from Northeastern University. And shortly thereafter, had my son, Callan, who was born in July of 2012, followed by my daughter, Kylie, in 2014. So at this point, I've been at Action for just under 10 years, And it's really, it's been a great place to be, and I've absolutely loved living in Gloucester. Every day I feel lucky and privileged to live here, and I never thought it would be in my future to live by the water. So it's really a privilege to be here.
Great. Now, tell us about your role as deputy director, and what does that involve?
Sure. So I actually, just to give you a little history, I started at Action, like I said, just under 10 years ago, really just as sort of a case manager working with folks who are coming in, low-income folks who are coming in for help with housing or public benefits. And so really I just served as a case manager. And over the course of about 8 or 9 years, I kind of worked my way up. I was the manager of the department, then the director, and just over a year ago, I became the deputy director of the agency. So in this capacity, my main role is really to make sure that the general day-to-day operations of the agency are happening smoothly and efficiently. So I manage all of the program directors within the agency to make sure that certain systems are in place, that, you know, we're meeting any kind of requirements related to any funding that we might have. Fortunately, I have a lot of fantastic people who I'm supervising, so it doesn't really, you know, require too much, but that is the crux of what my job is. I'm also in charge of overseeing our facilities manager, and because of, you know, the buildings and the properties that we own, that can also be a really big part of my job, depending on what projects we have going on. So, and just sort of working very, very closely with the executive director to determine what the direction of our agency should be, any new initiatives or how we should change things or funding that we should go after. So it's a pretty exciting and varied role, which keeps it interesting.
Good. Well, tell us, for the listening audience, what the products and services are for Action.
Sure. So Action is a community action agency. It's one of, I think, 23 or 24 throughout the state and many, many, many throughout the entire country. So community action agencies began during the War on Poverty, and we are designated as community action agency through a particular type of grant called the Community Services Block Grant. So that's very flexible funding and actually only a really small part of the funding that Action receives, but it does help fund some of the services, really what we call the client housing services. So under that sort of umbrella falls public benefits assistance, including, you know, help with SNAP, which is formerly known as food stamps, and accessing mass health, case management and counseling, any type of housing assistance really that runs the gamut from helping people who are on the verge of eviction to prevent that, and helping people access subsidized housing. We also have an emergency homeless shelter with 30 beds for individuals. And again, a lot of homelessness prevention services. In our education and training center, we have a HISEP program, which is was formerly the GED for young adults ages 16 through 24. We also have adult basic education, which also helps prepare people for the HISEP test. We have healthcare trainings. We have a home health aid program and a certified nurse aid program that we offer. Right now we're in the middle of the nurse aid program, and we intend to offer a home health aid program in the beginning of the new year, as well as sort of general academic and career coaching and job prep and job readiness skills. We have a home care department, which provides in-home care for elders and disabled adults to help them remain in their home and age in place. So that constitutes personal care, household chores, any kinds of errands or general companionship, medication reminders, some transportation to medical appointments, and caregiver respite and home health aid and hospice care as well. And then a very big portion of our services involves energy services. So this is a fuel assistance program that is, always well utilized. The heating costs have gotten better, but still it's very difficult for people who are on a limited income to be able to heat their home throughout the winter. So we help with heating costs. We do energy assessments and advice in terms of helping people lower their bills, lower their consumption. We do a lot of weatherization, which ranges from insulation, weather stripping. We have done new windows. We can do entire heating systems. We really do it for residential. We don't sort of go into the commercial area of that. Also replacing inefficient light bulbs, some appliances, And we also oversee, actually, the entire statewide energy program. So that's a pretty big job too.
Who are the clients? And when I say that, if I'm a renter, okay, mm-hmm. and yep. the landlord is not putting into the building or the apartment what maybe he or she should be, but I have to pay rent plus utilities, what are my options?
In terms of energy services or general services?
Energy services or, you know.
Sure. So one of the things, so our designation as a community action agency, we are able to serve individuals or households actually at or below 125% of the federal poverty level, which is pretty low. For people who are over that income, we're able to provide sort of information and referral services, we call them, but generally not financial services. So in the case of individuals who are having, or households who are having difficulty with a landlord, in that kind of situation, generally they would come up, they would do an intake at our front desk, and they would meet with an advocate. At that point, the advocate would go through with them what the issues are. Generally, that starts with just some information about them, their family, their tenancy, and then really getting down to the nitty-gritty of what's going on in that unit. So that might involve the advocate sort of acting as the intermediary between the tenant and the landlord. If communication has broken down, it might mean sort of educating the landlord about what they are supposed to do, what their obligation is as a landlord, and also letting the tenant know. We do a lot of tenants' rights education. A lot of people just really don't know what their rights are as a renter, and they have a lot of rights, so it's important that we let people know. And then at that point, also assess the situation to say, okay, well, look, if, you know, let's say you're paying these utility bills and your house is still really cold, maybe the home is in need of energy services, whether it be weatherization or, you know, weather stripping or insulation. And so at that point, a referral can be made over to our energy offices to see if that might be something that can be addressed in the unit as well.
Good. What are some of the other, we've got about 3 minutes left, what are some of the other things that Action is involved in terms of services what's hot? I mean, what do you, I know that they always had a big drive at Christmas that they do, I assume that's going to happen soon. And
absolutely. I'd love to put a big plug in for our Project Uplift. Which is a very large toy and clothing drive for the Cape Ann community. And I think it has been done for at least about 25 years. It's a huge program, a huge benefit to the agency, to the community. So what we do is we have donation boxes for toys and clothing spread throughout the community. So Cape Ann, we cover all of Cape Ann, so that's where the boxes are. And people are generally very, very generous with what they provide. So once those donations have been made, then people, actually in about, I want to say about 2 weeks, the applications for Project Uplift are going to be available on Action's website, which is www.actioninc.org, and they'll also be available at our main office, where our entrance is at 5 Pleasant Street. So I would definitely encourage folks who might be in need this holiday season to come in and fill out an application. And we're always looking for donations, sort of the older crowd, sort of 10 to 13, 14 is where we kind of lack gifts. People can buy anything and everything for a little toddler, a little baby, but it's that age range that's tough. So we're really looking forward to getting that up and running, and the program is for children ages 14 and under. So it's a pretty big range of folks that can come in and benefit from that program. So if you need help or you want to help, come see us.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Wish you the very best, and please do send me information about the Project Uplift, and maybe we can publicize it as the program goes underway.
That's great. Thanks so much for having me, Josh.
Okay, Maggie. Thank you.
Okay.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sock Asian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sock Asian Sportswear handles all aspects of your needs, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SockAsianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sock Asian Sportswear is the place to go.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at Historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our guest is Julie LaFontaine. Julie, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Always a pleasure to have you on our show, and wanted to chat a little bit about what the Open Door is doing. I know that you have a new endeavor I saw in the local Metropolitan Daily this morning, the Gloucester Times, but one of my former bosses used to call it that. I'm sorry. Tell us about what's going on with you in that article, and let's. I know you've got an event coming up Saturday in Rockport, I believe, and then you've got a food drive and lots of things happening. So tell us what's going on with you.
So sure, Josh. Certainly, lots going on. So let's start with the article in the Gloucester Times this morning. It was actually making the announcement that the Open Door is opening its doors to the Grace Center for a limited amount of time starting December 4th through March 26th to be open on Sundays. Last year we saw some record low temperatures on a day that there really are no public buildings open, and so in conjunction with the mayor and a lot of really great community volunteers, the Open Door opened up on Valentine's Day last year, which was a Sunday, and gave shelter to a couple dozen folks, and out of that, really, you know, the need was identified that there should be a place that people could go in out of the cold, especially, you know, during those months. And so we are working with the Grace Center in Action and the mayor, certainly the city, to provide a place for people to come in. We'll offer a simple meal. It'll be soup and sandwiches for lunch, and then the Open Door already has established a community meal program that's open on Sunday, and so folks who are here for the day would be able to stay through dinner and then go back to the shelter after.
Okay. That's great. And what is the event that you have coming up on Saturday?
So, you know, busy time of year, lots going on. So there are actually a couple things happening tomorrow on Saturday, November 5th. So at the ice cream store and the Bean and Leaf coffee shop in Rockport are both offering free ice cream and free coffee to customers. It's the end of their season, and they're inviting the public to come in and enjoy some libations and leave a generous tip for the Open Door, and all of those proceeds will go directly to support the holiday basket program at the Open Door this year. And then also tomorrow afternoon, Saturday, November 5th at 2 p.m. is the K-Band Stand-Up Paddleboard Turkey Paddle, and this is an annual event for them, and it is just it's a really fun, I think it's about a 1 mile race down and around in the Essex River and then coming back to enjoy some refreshments, but the proceeds will be also benefiting the Open Door.
Great. Great. And you are involved in doing stuff for folks at Thanksgiving. Tell us about that and how that
works.
And
so 'tis the season to be busy. You know, last year, between November and December, the Open Door provided more than 1,900 turkeys or turkey equivalents, and we call them turkey equivalents when we give a gift card, and all of the fixings to provide Thanksgiving meals and then meals for the December holidays. And the Open Door really focuses on making sure that families that want to eat at home with their own recipes, their own families, and their own traditions are able to do so. And then we work with the American Legion on Thanksgiving and Christmas Day. They do a really great job of preparing meals for people who don't have the ability to do that and have a meal delivered to their homes, and we work with them to help provide foodstuffs. So I think really between the American Legion, the Open Door, and a community that really cares, no one should be going without. So we have this holiday basket program. If folks want to participate in that, $30 will provide a turkey and all of the fixings for Thanksgiving feast. You can go to foodpantry.org to make that donation, or you can write a check to the Open Door and send it to 28 Emerson Avenue in Gloucester and write turkey in the memo line. And you can help make sure that Thanksgiving dinner gets on the table of someone who needs some help making ends meet this Thanksgiving.
And you said 1,900 last year?
19 between November and December, yes.
And that's in Gloucester only, or is that all of Cape Ann?
So that is within the Open Door service area, which includes Gloucester, Rockport, Manchester, Essex, and Ipswich. And
okay.
Then earlier this year, the Ipswich Community Food Pantry was merged with the Open Door, and that added several more cities and towns, contiguous cities and towns that we're serving. So, you know, we are planning this year to do at least as many as last year and then some with the extended service area, and have great faith in the community to help make all of this happen.
And what I'm sure there are, I know the letter carriers do stuff for you. I know the Rotary does stuff for you. What are some of the other organizations
there's no end to the generosity this time of year. I think as people are appreciating what they have in their own lives, they are, you know, in turn making sure that they're reaching out to help others. And so just, you know, there are dozens and dozens of places that are collecting food for the Open Door. But just to name a couple, some kind of interesting things, and we mentioned the Bean and Leaf and the ice cream store, but Northeast Cleaners right now is giving you $1 off your dry cleaning for every item that you donate to their food drive. So the more items you donate, the bigger your discount. We also have over in Manchester, our service area includes Manchester, 7 Central is going to be doing a food drive on the 22nd of November, and they will be inviting patrons in to bring food items and food collection for Thanksgiving. And so, again, just, you know, this is just a few samplings of the things that are out there, and we just so appreciate everyone coming together for this. But kind of our great big push is always the Saturday before Thanksgiving. We work with the radio station North Shore 104.9 to do a big Thanksgiving food drive. And this year we will actually be at 5 different locations. We'll be at Market Basket, Shaw's and Stop and Shop in Gloucester. We'll be at Shaw's in Ipswich, and working with the Ipswich YMCA at the Market Basket in Rowley to do a community-wide food collection. So from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., folks can come down, do some shopping, do their own shopping, and pick up a couple extra items and bring them out. There'll be volunteers there in our trucks, and we'll be collecting food that day. Last year, on that day, we collected about 17,000 pounds of food. So it's just
17,000 tons of food.
Of food, yes, and so it's astounding when everyone does a little bit, it has a big result.
I have to get my 17,000 tons.
No pounds. Pounds.
Oh, pounds. Okay, all right. Tons. Pounds. Okay, all right. All right.
Yeah.
Pounds of food. All right. All right. I just want to make sure.
It is astounding.
Yeah.
You know, pounds are astounding.
tons would be very astounding. Yeah. I don't know that we would have room for that. But what we do have is 17,000 pounds of food that people are bringing in just to make sure that everyone in the community has what they need for the holidays. And then, you know, it's not just Thanksgiving that you need food. It's, you know, during the winter months, there are higher heating bills and other things that really can cause some financial distress for families and make them struggle to get food on the table. And so this food, it goes into our warehouse and will be distributed out over the coming month.
I had a question to ask you that I may have asked you before, but I don't remember what the answer is, and that is, I'm somebody who needs food, and I have a pet. If somebody, would you ever give pet food to people who have pets?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. The Open Door actually underwent a major renovation, and we just completed that and cut the ribbon on it in January earlier this year. And part of that renovation included a corner that we call Dusky's Corner. Hmm. And in that corner, there is cat and dog food stocked. Understanding that if people are struggling to feed themselves, they may also be struggling to feed a pet. So that corner is actually funded and stocked in partnership with the Cape Ann Animal Aid. It's a natural place if you're coming to get food for yourself that you might get food for your pets as well.
Great. So if people wanted to donate food for pets, they would just pick that up as well?
They absolutely could. This Thanksgiving food drive really is focused on people.
Yep.
But it's good for folks to be aware that, you know, we do try to help families and households meet that additional need for a pet.
Great. Well, I want to thank you, as always, for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know that you go a million different places, but appreciate your coming on and sharing some of your thoughts and certainly all the good work that you do in the community helping the disadvantaged.
Well, it is always a pleasure. And, you know, our theme this year has been centered around hashtag nourish. And there are just so many ways that we nourish ourselves and we nourish the community. It's through food, it's through relationships, and it's through working together. So I'm just pleased to be part of the community. And thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Julie. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was an interesting hour.
Yeah.
Now we have, as you mentioned, it's Veterans Day next Friday, so we'll be off next Friday. We're going to be off the weekend of Thanksgiving.
Right.
We'll be off that weekend too. We're going to be off the Friday before Christmas. I need a day off.
That's all right. That's fine.
And I do want to mention we've got we'll get to your lineup in a minute here, but we do have football coverage coming up tonight. It's going to be a little bit different. Due to the fact there's no press box in Marblehead, it's very difficult for us to get our broadcasting gear in there. In fact, it's more than difficult. It's impossible. However, Andrew Nicastro is going to bring his video camera, and we're going to put up some live streaming video. We're going to broadcast the game live with our video. And Paul Ingram and I are going to sit in the stands with Andrew, and we're going to plug our microphones into the camera. So we won't have the normal broadcast quality. We won't have access to our playlist, and we won't have probably won't be able to keep accurate stats, if at all, but we will be able to broadcast the game, and that is Gloucester at Marblehead. That's a Division 2A playoff game. Now Paul Ingram will be with me. Bill Newell will be in North Reading, and he will be covering the Danvers at North Reading game, and the situation is similar there. There's not a lot of room, if any, for him in the press box. So Bill will either be broadcasting live, or he'll be filing reports that will come to us, and of course he'll be tweeting right on our website. So we do have coverage of Danvers at North Reading. We have coverage, live coverage, minimally video coverage of the Gloucester at Marblehead game tonight. And of course tomorrow we have Beverly at Tewksbury. That will be on Channel A, on Radio Channel A, with Marty Smith and Tim Kearns. So we've got you covered this weekend, and we'll have interviews and videos and all kinds of good stuff all during the weekend. So please check out MSO News Sports from time to time and tell other people about it. Now, Josh, trending now coming up in the near future or the far future?
We will have a show on the 18th, and I'm lining up guests for that. Just going back to your point, you're saying that Marblehead doesn't have a fresh box?
Correct.
Why don't we put a plug into the Regional Vocational School carpentry program to see if they could go build them one?
Well, I don't know where they'd put it. They don't really have a location.
They don't have a location.
No, the near stands abut the gymnasium and the timekeeper and the public address announcer. There are two windows in the gymnasium that are right adjacent to the stands. And so they stick their heads out there and they keep the clock and they keep the PA that way. But there's no place to put a press box on the near stands, which are very, very shallow. And on the far stands, similar situation, there's no place to build one. I mean, it would be a great expense because they'd have to build a tower to put it up there. So, you know, it was just didn't do it. And some of these other schools, it's just the way it is, I guess. You got to save costs somewhere, and you know, different schools do it different ways. So we're gonna do the best we can. It's a shame we can't get into Marblehead, you know, to do this the way we want to do it. But we'll get some coverage up there, and that was a good idea.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so what are you working on?
Lots of good people from social services, elected officials, people from the arts.
Probably law enforcement as whoever gets elected.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll try to reach out to somebody on the national level.
I think it's amazing that I can't. You know, we've got two people who I think are completely despicable. One absolutely more despicable than the other. So for me, it's going to be a horrific choice either way. And I mean that sincerely. I think both parties could have done a lot better than they did.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how many write-ins there are across the board. Not just people picking a third or fourth or fifth party candidate, because there are certainly those on some of the ballots around the country. I'll bet you'll see a lot of write-ins.
Okay, that's Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, producer and engineer Bill Proposky. That's it. Don't forget football tonight on MSO News Sports. Trending now on demand. Check it out. Bye-bye.